The Yeshiva Gedol of Johannesburg proudly presents the Wednesday evening shiur, covering the Parashas HaShavua, the Yomim Tovim, and other special topics as delivered by its founder and Rosh HaYeshiva, Rabbi Israel Chaim Goldfein, Zichrono Livrocha. Details regarding how to order additional shiurim follow immediately after the conclusion of the shiur.
As Nati said, we have a very illustrious crowd here this evening, which not only friends but wonderful friends and wonderful people of the Johannesburg Jewish community. And we thank you all for coming, and we know that a great number went to great effort to be here with us this evening. We appreciate it, and we hope that you will all have a very enjoyable evening, both physically and spiritually, a very enjoyable Reish Kiddush. I certainly want to second the Mazel Tov given to Rabbi and Mrs. Hendler on being appointed the spiritual leader of the Cyril Dean Hebrew Congregation, a neighboring shul. Rabbi Hendler not only was a Talmud, a disciple of the yeshiva, but he was in the very first group, from the first two Talmidim of the yeshiva, and also from the first two graduates of the yeshiva. And we wish him great success together with the Cyril Dean congregation, which is very well represented here this evening. We hope that great things will be achieved. And secondly, I certainly want to second the Mazel Tov to our very dear friend Oscar Koren, who, although is past the mid-60s in age, but he is still retaining his youth, not slowing up, and still training the whole year for this swim, this winter swim, to get into that ice-cold water and raise money for various charities in the community, which the yeshiva is a major beneficiary. And we wish to Oscar and his wife many, many more years of good health, good training, good swimming. The topic of this evening's talk is what is wrong with the educational systems of the Western world. Most will agree that the educational systems and institutions of today most likely have the greatest impact and influence on the development of the individual. From the tender age of 3 or 4 years old until the mid-20s, parents subject the most formative years of their sons and daughters to a system where the majority of their waking hours will be spent. From this system, the foundation of the individual will be hewed and hammered out, and subsequently direct his later life. Perhaps the only rival to such a profound influence was the home. But today, in our go-go society, with countless distractions from home life and even ultimate breakdown of the home structure, this might have become a thing of the past. So when we're speaking of educational systems, we are speaking of something very significant and very serious. Educationists differ as to what should be the major emphasis and priority of these systems. And there are three major areas in which they differ. There's the practitioner, that schools must be career orientated. They must produce doctors, lawyers, accountants, scientists. Or, not long ago, before the fall of Russia, Jeff Sumter of Anglo-American wrote a paper saying that the West is falling behind because they're not producing enough engineers like Russia is. Or there are those who say we are falling behind the East, Japan, because we are not concentrating on enough mathematics or high tech. Or we need more sophisticated computer training. Or, to the converse, there are those that say that with the merging of the third world with the first world, which is something that's not only taking place in South Africa. Many times South Africans feel that the problems they have at home are only in South Africa. This is a phenomenon that's going throughout the entire world. So there's too much sophisticated education and career training. We must concentrate on basic developments, more technicons, trade schools, small business training, and so forth. But the Untersuchung, the sum total is you have to prepare the student to be able to make a living and contribute to the national economy. That's one opinion. Then you have another opinion, the academic, the theory. Not long ago, I was at a UNISA graduation, and the dean spoke of theoretical sciences versus the practical sciences, versus the applied sciences. That even though we must be able to apply our knowledge, he says universities were not created for that. But universities were created for the pursuit of wisdom, whether you can apply it to make some money out of it or not. There must be the quest for wisdom and for philosophy. Man was not created only to be a money-making machine. So this is a second opinion as to where the emphasis should be put. A third area, pursuit of the arts, the finer and higher things of life. Strive for perfection. Arts, music, literature, culture, the creation and pursuit of a higher human being. Here's where emphasis must be placed. Otherwise, we're going to create a very primary type of person. What is the Torah viewpoint in regards to these three areas? When it comes to career planning, career orientation, the Mishnah and the Sechta Kiddushin tells us that it is a very, very great obligation upon a father to teach a son how to make a living. Ahav chayim lalamdei es b'nai umnes. And whoever fails in this, ki ilo malamdei listis. He is teaching the son how to become a gangster. Because if a man goes out into the world and he's not prepared, so eventually you'll drive him to dishonest pursuits. So that there's no doubt about. When it comes to the pursuit of wisdom, Jews always were the pursuers of wisdom. The Torah tells us, Im yesh chokma, im yemaloch odom, yesh chokma bagoyim tamin. If someone will tell you that there is wisdom by the nations of the world, believe him. Because there is great wisdom. Natural sciences, worldly sciences. The fact is, Hareya kochom mechach mea umes, that when you see a person, you meet a person who is wise in the knowledge of the nations, chayiv lebarech, we are obligated to make a brocha, a blessing. We bless the Almighty, asher nosan mechochmosai, the boss of Adon, who has given from his wisdom to flesh and blood. So there is no doubt that we are great admirers of wisdom. When it comes to pursue the finer things of life, Torah always taught the man to have a great admiration for beauty and for perfection. If you take our own liturgy, our own prayers, we're very far from that today. But it was 1,000 years ago that our scholars wrote the most beautiful literature and the most beautiful poetry, the piyuti, which are incorporated in our daily and festival prayers. When the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, will be rebuilt, we will find out that the Shiras HaLevi'im, the song of the Levites, will far surpass all of the music of the world. David HaMelech, the psalmist, has been an inspiration for the greatest writers of the nations. So we certainly agree with that. However, there's a fourth area which is omitted from this entire discussion by the Western educationists. And this area is not an insignificant or a small area, but it's awesome. Awesome both from the perspective of its importance and of its vastness. And this, the Torah tells us. Why was man placed here? Why was man created? The above areas of endeavor are all means to a particular end. But what was his purpose? And on this the Torah states, Re'ei nosati lefanecha hayom es hachayim ves hatov es hamoves ves hara uvachat v'chayim. Behold, I have placed before you today life, and that what is good, and death, and that what is evil. And I command thee to choose life. Man was placed on this world in order to choose between what is right and what is wrong, to choose between what is good and what is evil, to pursue the good and to remove himself and distance himself from evil, and to teach this to his household and to his children. Like the Almighty said to Abraham, to Abraham, Leman asher yotzade es bonav ubeisei achrov. I have chosen Abraham because I know that he will teach his household and his children after him, lasseis, to do what is good and justice, what is upright. This is not, though, merely lip service. This is not something to choose between good and evil, which permeates every facet of human life. Is not something which a person can acquire with words alone or with thoughts alone. It is a wisdom. And it is a wisdom which surpasses all other wisdoms. Like King Solomon said, and he should know because he was a chokham, he called Odom, he knew all of the wisdoms of the world. Reishis chokma yiris Hashem. The fear of the Almighty and to walk in his ways and to emulate him is not merely a wisdom, it is the source of all wisdoms. And all nations were commanded in this, not only Israel. The nations of the world were commanded in this through the perspective of 7 commandments. Israel, through the perspective of 613 commandments. We always hear parents say, oh, definitely, I always tell my son and my daughter, the most important thing is, even more important than your education, is to be good. But you don't acquire the reishis chokhmah, the wisdom of all wisdoms, with that well-meaning but hollow parental statement. Who is teaching this? The schools say, this is not our area, belongs to the home. The home says, but my children are never home. This is why I send them to school. The government says, we can't mix in this. It belongs to the church. And the church says, if they don't come to church. So who is teaching this? Now let me just elaborate a little more in what this actually encompasses. For example, Today we live in a world of violence and bloodshed. The Torah tells us, Shefik dama odom ba odom domi shofik. He would tell him elikim osa esa odom. He who spills the blood of another man, his blood should be spilt, because he has destroyed the image of the Almighty, because man was created in his image. The whole world was commanded on this. Not only Israel. Even on the taking of one life. And it states, Lo yechupar ha'oretz. The land does not become atoned until a death is revenged. This is something which particularly applies, the Torah tells us, to Eretz Yisrael. There, the land certainly cannot tolerate bloodshed. And it states, Yitamu ha'oretz. The land becomes impure from this. The Rambam Maimonides writes that there is no aveira, there is no transgression. Mikol aveiros, from all transgressions of the Torah that cause so much destruction to society as this. Look in the world we live today. Blood is cheap. Man is cheap. We can kill off millions in a war. Someone told me a statement, I couldn't believe it. And I told them, please, find the source. That Stalin was responsible for the death of 60 million Russians. I know by Hitler, Yamach Shemari. It says 20 million, 25 million. They say in the last century it was cataloged over 100 wars. What does the Torah tell us? When a man is found dead in a city, then that city must not rest until his blood is avenged. One murder. And if the murder couldn't be found, the judges of the court had to come and they had to bring a sacrifice and ask for forgiveness, because they were held responsible for allowing a breakdown in law and order. Not only killing, violence also. It states that if a Jew raises his hand, or a non-Jew raises his hand to hit someone, Nikra Rosho, he is called an evil man. Like we see by Moshe, where he said, Rosho loma sakereyeho, when he saw the two Hebrews fighting, one raising his hand to the other, he called them a Rosho. The Gemara goes further. Gemara goes, we are not allowed to inflict any pain on another individual. Modern Chagiga tells us that if you do something in the presence of another person and it causes him a pain, even if it's not a physical pain, you'll have to pay for it. You'll be called to task. It says, for example, if you kill an insect that makes another person squeamish, or if you spit in the presence of another person, or if you embarrass another person, or if you bring him under suspicion. Now, I'm quoting very few principles of what there is written volumes on. This is what it means to study bloodshed or violence. We'll go to another area. The area of business ethics, integrity, honesty, what we hear so much talk about today. Torah tells us, Hagezel shaveh pruta min ha'oni ki ilo gezel es nafshoi. You steal one small coin from a poor man, the Almighty holds you responsible as if you have taken his life. And non-Jews also are commanded on theft. And this is considered from their very most severest transgressions. The Torah tells us, Kosha Einshel Shel Mishkoles Minarais. A man who has false weights and measures in his shop, he is transgressing a law which is more severe than adultery and incest. This is what the Torah tells us. Because this has to do with relations between man and his fellow man. Other areas you can ask forgiveness for it. But here you cannot until you return the money, and you won't know who to return the money because this was his regular practice. The Torah tells us that in the relationships between an employer and employee, there are countless laws that an employer has to know how to fairly and justly treat his employee. Countless laws that takes enormous study. At the same time, the employee is also commanded to give his employer a fair day's work. The Rambam writes on this particular subject, just as the employer must give a fair and square deal to his employee, so is it with the employee. For example, he has no right to hire himself out and to work all night and then pitch up at his job in the morning where he's too tired to do his work well. Or he has no right to hire his animal to a person and then work that animal at night so the animal cannot give fair labor to the person he hired it to. Just like the employer is commanded not to steal from the employee, so is the poor employee commanded not to steal from the balabais. What does this mean? Take off a few minutes here, we'll have a cup of coffee here, and we'll make a telephone call here on the boss's time, and have a schmooze here, and then the whole day goes by bimirmo, where he didn't give his employer a fair day's labor. And these are considered from the primary most important laws in the Torah. He has to be exacting, just as he expects his employer to be exacting with him with wages, so must he be exacting with his employer on his time. And the Rambam says, you want to see how far this goes, because when he eats and benches, they allowed him not to say the fourth brocha, which is only an obligation from the rabbis in order not to take away too much time from his employer. And he has to work with all of his strength, like Yaakov, like our father Jacob, when he went to work for Laban. And Laban was not a righteous man. He was a rosha. Still, Yaakov said, "Bechol kechi avadati es abichem. I worked for your father with all of my strength." And this is why the Rambam writes, Yaakov became such a wealthy man in this world. The same thing when it comes, we have all types of sections of laws that deals with avodim, with slaves. Those days, Jews owned slaves. but they were commanded on their obligation to them. Let me also quote what the Rambam writes on this. One is allowed to give hard work to his slave. But even though this is the letter of the law, Midas Chassidus, the Torah tells us this is not the way for the wise of Israel to do. But rather, she odem brachman. A Jew is supposed to be compassionate. He is supposed to pursue tzedek. Le'yachbid ulei al abdo. He's not supposed to overwork his servant. He's not supposed to pain him. He should give him to eat and drink from everything that he himself eats and drinks. Chachomim rishonim. The early sages, the early sages used to give to their slaves from every plate and every dish that was served to them. And they used to instruct their household that first you must take care of the animals and the slaves, and only afterwards to serve himself. You should not shame them. You should not insult them. You should not shout at them. They were given to you for work and not to embarrass. And you should listen to their complaints and judge them with accordingly. Cruelty and arrogance, this is found only amongst the idolaters. But the seed of Abraham, they pursue the path of the Almighty. And just as the Almighty is a marachim al kol, he has compassionate al kol b'yisov to all of his creatures, so must we. This is in regards to the area of what we would call integrity and ethics in areas of business and human relations. We'll go to another area: immorality, promiscuity, adultery and incest. Today we are seeing unparalleled moral decay to the point where, as mentioned, the home, which was the cornerstone of society and civilization, is crumbling. For 1 minute, let's examine the progression of this, or rather the regression. There was a time, not too long ago, when schools were always separate from boys and girls. But then came the mixing of the schools. I remember in my time, schools were mixed, but playgrounds were separate and entrances were separate. You can still pass by old schools and you see one entrance that says boys and the other girls. But then this was done away with. Then came dating at young ages. Then we became more liberal, the liberal movement. We tried to get away from the Victorian age. And there was dating without chaperones, without supervision. Wasn't long that we saw even the mixing of hostels and dormitories. From here, there came promiscuity in the media, movies, television, relaxing of censorships, pornography, immodest dress, nudity on beaches. From here, acceptance of premarital sex. Further, eventually the doing away with the institution of marriage. Live-in partners. Then the acceptance of extramarital sex. Problems of illegitimacy, of abortion, of legalized abortion. Acceptance of homosexuality. Then we witness times of rampant rape, gang rape, sexual abuse of children. male and female prostitution, white slave trade, children prostitution, international syndicates, until we come to the plague of AIDS. The ramifications have been enormous. Breakdown of the home, of the marriage, divorce has skyrocketed, illegitimacy has skyrocketed, psychological and psychiatric wrecks of children, welfare, teenage suicide, children suicide, and subsequently the young generations bringing this all into their home. Now some of you might think, we're getting a little hysterical here, we're carrying it too far, it can't be that bad. I heard this talk about a year ago from a sociologist, and she said the same thing, and she says, I want to tell you, no, it's not that bad. This is the tip of the iceberg. It is far, far worse than we can even think. And I'll give you some examples. We mentioned abortions. In the United States, these are statistics that were published this month in Time magazine, there are 1.6 million abortions, we're not speaking of spontaneous abortions, each year. This represents almost one-fourth of all pregnancies. One-fourth of all pregnancies are aborted by choice. 46% of all American women will have had one abortion by age of 45. 46%, that's one out of every two almost. 11% of all abortions will be by teenage girls under 18. That's in regards to abortion. We mentioned sexual abuse of children. Most sexual abuse of children is by parents or family. So we're talking here of incest. When I once gave this talk about a year ago, a year and a half ago, I had written down that one-third of all girls and one-sixth of all boys in the world or in the West will be sexually abused by their parents. When I saw these statistics again, I thought, no, I must have made a mistake. One out of every three girls will be abused by their parents, can't they? So I phoned my son-in-law. Leonard Carr was a psychologist. So he told me, he'll give me the latest statistics. This is what he told me. There was a recent confidential questionnaire which was handed out to 57% of South African university males. Males who attend university. If they ever experienced sexual abuse in childhood. Excuse me. There was a questionnaire that was handed out to university, South African university males, of which 57% wrote that they have experienced sexual abuse in childhood. Over one out of every two. The supervisors of this poll pointed out the following, that there are usually three times as much sexual abuse in female children than there are in male children. This was a poll given to male children. So we can multiply that by three times. Secondly, most abuse comes by parents, relatives, or grandparents. Thirdly, the figures should accelerate in the lower income class. These were university students. I don't see how they could accelerate. Another statistic. In France, 50 to 60,000 children per year are sexually abused. The Irish Republic, one in every four females before the age of 18. England, they have a special incest crisis line which receives 1,500 calls per week. That's what the sociologist said. It's far worse far worse than we know of, and that we should know of. Not to mention other offshoots from this, which is we're hearing quite a bit about today, child beating and wife beating. What is the Torah perspective of this? Taras Ha'odam v'Taras HaMishpocha. One of the prime goals in the Torah is to create a sanctity and a purity in man and in his home. I'm always amazed by the story in the Torah of Shimon and Levi. When their sister Dina was abducted and she was raped, they went without their father's permission, without Yaakov's permission, they went to the city that was responsible for this, and they killed off every man in the city. All of the rest they took captives, and they took the spoils of the city, the slaves, the cattle, the sheep, the horses and the donkey. They led it out of the city, and then they burnt the entire city. Can you imagine the sight when our patriarch Yaakov, Jacob, hears his two sons coming home, and with them they have tens of thousands of cattle and of donkeys and of horses and of sheep and goats and of captives. And he asks him, Ribbono shel Olam, what is happening? What did you do? And they said, we killed off every man in that city that raped our sister, and we burnt the city. And Yaakov said, how could you do such a thing? All of the nations now will rise up against me, and I'm a household here of only a few people. And they answered, Hakizaona, will we allow our sister to be raped? This is what Tarish Israel, this was what purity was by Israel. This was their perspective. All right, Jacob didn't agree with them. They went a little too far. But we could see what the brothers were thinking about. It's a different world. How dare you lay a hand on our sister? And it wasn't a nobody. It was the prince, it was the son of the king of Shechem. And they said, we don't care if it's a prince, we don't care if it's the king. He also is guilty. Torah's perspective is that a home is a mishkan. It's the sanctuary where the Almighty dwells between man and wife. And there must be tranquility in the home. There must be total loyalty in the home. There must be serenity in the home. There must be shalom, peace in the home. And then the Shekhinah is Shruya. The Almighty dwells, and it becomes a sanctuary to the Almighty and for the children that will come forth. This is what a home was by Israel. Rambam writes again, he says, first the Gemara says, a person has to be very, very careful about the honor of his wife. Because bracha, physical blessing, comes into the world, comes into his home because of his wife. As we see, Abraham became wealthy because of Sarah. A person must be very careful the way he speaks to his wife, because her tears are close to come. The Rambam states, V'chein tzivu chachomim, the sages commanded us, how should our homes be? A man must honor his wife more than he honors himself. He must love his wife like he loves himself. If he has wealth, then he must share it with her. He must honor her in accordance to his wealth. He must not cast upon her an unnecessary fear. When he speaks with her, it must be with pleasantness. He should not be angry in her presence, nor should he be depressed and sad in her presence. Became Siva, and so did they command the woman that she should honor her husband to the utmost, and she should look at him as if he is a prince, with a desire to fulfill all of his wishes. This is the way of the sons of Israel and the daughters of Israel in their marriages and in their homes, which are built on sanctity and purity. And if this is kept, then there will always be praise and peace in their tents. How does this look in the world that we're living today? Who is teaching this, to all of these things, to our children? This is not career orientation. This is not pursuit of theoretical wisdom, nor this is pursuit of the arts and the music, but rather this is the pursuit on how to be a human being. And who is teaching it? The father and the mother tell the child, you must always be good, that's the most important thing, and that's the end of the lesson. In the schools and in the institutions, it's not covered. Rambam writes, if a man had enough money to buy one candle, and it was Shabbos and Hanukkah, should he buy a Shabbos candle or should he buy a Hanukkah candle? If he had enough money for either wine or a Shabbos candle and it wasn't Hanukkah, states he should buy the Shabbos candle, because the Shabbos candle represents peace, and peace comes first. If he had enough money for wine and a Hanukkah candle, he should buy the Hanukkah candle, because that represents the great miracle. But what happens now if he has enough money? He can buy either a Shabbos candle or a Hanukkah candle. What should he do? So the Rambam brings from the Gemara their basic item. First, he must buy the Shabbos candle. And he adds a reason. He says, the Gemara said, because this represents peace. He says, because Godel Hashol, peace in one's home, is so great, Shekolaterem Nitna, Lase Sholem Baleil. The whole Torah was given for the purpose of bringing peace. The Almighty, at one place, erased his name in order to bring peace into the world, into the peace into one home. Shedrochecha darkei noam. Her ways are ways of pleasantness. Bechol nisivoseho shalom, and all of the paths are peace. There are many, many other areas which we don't have time to go into this evening. Let me just mention the titles. For example, good midas, good characteristics, arrogance or humility, anger, compassion, loving kindness, charity, speech, how one is obligated to control his speech. But the Vilna Gaon constantly writes, this is the most serious aveda in the entire Torah. When one doesn't control his speech properly, he speaks badly about other people. Or nivul peh, profanities, which we see today seems to be the vogue. Derech-eretz, that a person is supposed to go dress properly. He's supposed to be able to mix with people. And then there's the final area of Yiras Hashem, to fear the Almighty, who you are accountable to. If a person has no fear of the Almighty, then he is not accountable to anyone. If he's not accountable to anyone, then we get a world like we see today. When Abraham, Abraham came into a city that he didn't know of, he told his wife Sarah, say you're my sister, because if they know you're my wife, they will kill me and take you. Why did he do this? Because he said that Akein Yiras Elokim Bamokam Hazeh, he saw there was no fear of the Almighty in this city. It wasn't long ago that there was an interesting article, an editorial in Newsweek magazine, and it was called Among Urban Youth We Have Reproduced the Historic Conditions for a Warrior Class. In other words, our educational systems are producing warriors. It was written by James Q. Wilson, who's professor at University of California, Los Angeles, and president of the American Political Science Association. He writes, he says, the 19th century coped with the consequences of industrialism and urbanization by what is now derided as Victorian morality, including the idea of the gentleman. The aspiration was in the word gentling. The idea involved such seemingly but not really minor matters as table manners and sportsmanship. Alas, the modern age is concerned with personality rather than character. Character is rigid, elitist, moralistic. Personality is spontaneous, democratic. Elites abandoned the ethic of character, an ethic that encouraged and even enforced right conduct. And he speaks in people, professions. We are teaching them subjects. We are teaching them arts. But we are forgetting to teach them how to be a man, how to be a human being. And therefore, we are producing warriors that are destroying society, destroying the home, destroying the world. Critics will say the schools will engage in moral, political, religious, or indoctrination. They said to him, this is what's going to happen. Wilson answered, I certainly hope so. Do it, but do it wisely. Our question is, this great body of law, of ethics, of character building, of character development, of choosing between right and evil, between life and death, of emulating the Almighty, where is it being taught? In Western society. We're in particular referring to secular schools, even our own Torah schools, that place the major emphasis, perhaps can also learn a great deal today from what is said here, in view of the situations, the enormous situations that they find themselves with, the background of the world and the community, the home that the child comes from. Let us hope and pray that the light of Torah will begin and continue to emerge and will bring Torah values which were sanctified by our past forefathers to the youth of today, which not only will they become great scientists or great business people, but they will become great people. And from them will emerge a light to the rest of the world, to fulfill the prophecy and the task that was given to the nation of Israel, that they shall be a light unto the entire world. Thank you very much.
The Yeshiva Gedola hopes that you have learned much from the presentation. For further information or to order additional shiurim, please contact the Yeshiva Gedola of Johannesburg. Visit us on the web at www.ygj.co.za or contact us via email at audio@ygj.co.za, via phone at 011-648-7906, via fax at 011-648-0085, and via post at P.O. Box 66226, Broadway 2020, Johannesburg, South Africa.